to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, Waterworks. Dr. David Schindler's lifelong interest in water has earned him this year's Gerhard Hertzberg Medal. This recognizes his achievements as Canada's top scientist. And Dr. Peter Sargis is not only a practicing physician, he's also a proponent of telehealth, so he was a natural to lead the health informatics unit at the Alberta Research Council. And a step back in time, historian Catherine Cole talks about her book on Alberta's inventors and the thousands of patents they hold. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. To biology students at the University of Alberta, he's the professor who teaches some of the most interesting courses. Around the world, Dr. David Schindler is known as one of the best researchers on aquatic systems. From acid rain to phosphates and a whole host of problems in between, he's had a hand in getting to the root of these concerns and their effect on our precious resource, water. Among the high honors that David Schindler has earned for his scientific achievements are the 1992 Stockholm Water Prize, this summer he was inducted into the Royal Society of London, and finally, an honor from home, the NSERC Gerhard Hertzberg Medal for Scientific Excellence.
I think I've always been hooked on water from my earliest days. I can remember being fascinated by lakes. I grew up in the lake country of northern Minnesota. And when my mother or grandmother would take me to the lakes, that was a big deal. I think some of my earliest memories at age 2 or 3 years old were of really looking forward to going to the lakes. And then when I became a little bit older, I became an avid fisherman and spent most of my childhood and teens fishing one place or another in my spare time. As a result of that, got interested in some of the other organisms I saw. So it was rather natural.
How did that lead then into actually turning it into a scientific career? What was your first research in that sense?
Well, it was kind of a coincidence. I had actually temporarily abandoned any thought of doing anything biological because my misguided high school counselors told me that there was no career in biology except for being a high school teacher. So I went off to university to be a physicist and found an engineering physics program was pretty boring. I was always pretty good at math, and that's all it was applied math. But I spotted an ad for a summer job working for a biologist who wanted to determine the energy content of organisms to see how it was passed up food chains, and bomb calorimetry in those days was freshman physics, so I knew all of that stuff. So I went and applied to him for a job and found that I was visiting some of my favorite water bodies and getting organisms from them to run, and also picking books off his shelf that I would borrow and read during the summer. And he was a big influence on my career. So that fall, I changed universities, changed majors, and I've never looked back. From that day on, I wanted a PhD and to do research in water, and that's been my goal ever since.
Some of the research that you're working on now, you have several different areas, and I know that you've also been up in the mountains looking at the lakes there. What are some of the things that you're working on?
Okay, I've always liked to work on a cross-section that spanned biology and chemistry and sometimes even the physics of lakes. And I think more and more I focused my attention on lakes in the boreal forest and in alpine regions. I spent about 24 years working on boreal lakes alone before moving to Alberta, first in eastern Ontario and then for 22 years at the Experimental Lakes area. So I got to have a good feel of how the watersheds of lakes and the forests that surrounded them interacted with lakes to change the conditions for aquatic organisms. And then, of course, alpine lakes are just a totally different system altogether. But over the years, I've worked on the effects of nutrients, effects of acid rain on boreal lakes, effects of ultraviolet radiation, climate warming, and the interactions among all of those. And more recently, in the alpine lakes, I've also worked on the effect of alien fish species that were stocked in fishless lakes early in the 20th century and the impact that they've had on alpine communities.
You've talked about the ultraviolet radiation as an example. What's happening there?
One thing that we've found in our research is that there is a big connection between ultraviolet radiation, climate warming, and acid rain for freshwater systems. All of our lakes and rivers are connected to the terrestrial landscapes, of course. A lot of the water runs through wetlands and wet terrestrial soils. And as it does, it picks up a colored carbon material, which we call DOC, for dissolved organic carbon. And everyone has seen this. If you make tea in a glass, you notice it turns a yellow color. Or if you dip a bottle of water out of a stream, you'll notice the same thing. Well, that colored material is an almost perfect sunscreen that helps to protect aquatic organisms. And what we've found is that as soils and wetlands dry during climate warming, they produce less and less of this to go into lakes. So the lakes get clearer and clearer, but also ultraviolet light penetrates deeper and deeper. And in the case of acidification, it catalyzes this bleaching of this material and the breakdown, so the lakes clear even faster. So if you look at the relative effects of stratospheric ozone depletion, climate warming, and acidification on the ultraviolet regime that aquatic organisms have to endure, acidification is the most important, followed by climate warming, and ultraviolet radiation from the sky is affected by stratospheric ozone is a distant third. So it's a much more complicated situation than we've seen in the very simplistic approaches that have only looked at stratospheric ozone alone.
Is that part of a natural process, or is there something else going on there?
Well, the ultraviolet, as we know, is affected firstly by the CFCs and other ozone-depleting chemicals that we're putting into the atmosphere. The acid rain is human-caused, to a very large degree. And climate warming, while there is still a tiny bit of debate, I think it's fair to say that the majority of it is probably due to human-induced greenhouse gas increases in the atmosphere as well. So humans are having a big overall effect on our aquatic systems by these indirect things. Then on top of those large-scale but indirect things, we're doing direct modifications to the landscapes that drain into lakes, destroying wetlands, adding fertilizers, removing trees from the riparian areas. And there are also direct impacts on lakes. In general, for a good part of southern Canada, we're overfishing the populations of predatory fish in the lakes, which alone causes some enormous changes to aquatic systems. More or less like we've seen on the land for deer and elk populations, when we remove their natural predators like wolves and bears, and then the human exploitation isn't enough. We get huge herds of them that knock the vegetation down, like we see in the national parks right now with elk populations. So this throwing of the whole aquatic system out of balance by removing predators is also a part of the process. So for any lake, you could probably write a prescription of 7 or 8 different things that would need to be done simultaneously to help recover these systems, and it would differ so that almost every lake you would approach would have a different prescription. And typically, we're still looking at those problems one at a time. We never fully solve any of them. Our score is usually to half solve them. and then add more problems. So we have these collections of half-solved or poorly addressed problems that are the real reason why our water quality is going downhill.
If you were studying diabetes or getting into nanotechnology, it'd probably be a more positive future in the sense that things could happen. How do you feel being on the ecology side and dealing with water and having this political issue in the sense and having to, really stand at the top of the mountain and yell out that we need to pay attention to this? What's it like?
I find that the public in general understands this issue very clearly. It's hard to get through to politicians. They tend to focus on dollars. And, of course, they only look at the dollars on one side of the balance sheet. The number of deaths and hospitalizations and treatment that we need from gastrointestinal diseases caused by water, it's assumed that the public will pick up those costs. And the same with air pollution and the costs of lost fisheries or increased costs of water treatment just don't figure in municipal or provincial budgets. So somehow we have to get through to them that there are more ways to promote our economy by saving these and preventing expensive treatment and cleanups rather than just producing more widgets to flog in stores.
What lies ahead in terms of your research?
I haven't really decided yet. There's been so much going on since I got the money connected with this Hertzberg Prize that I'm hoping for a few weeks of quiet to think this thing through with the help of a few colleagues over the Christmas break. The options range from trying to spend a lot of the money to take on something entirely new to just upgrading all of the various areas I've been working in that we've been talking about. And it's a tough decision to make because we have need for both.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Cheryl.
Dr. David Schindler is a Killam Memorial Professor in Ecology at the University of Alberta. He's the recipient of NSERC's 2001 Gerhard Hertzberg Medal for Scientific Excellence. And part of the reward is up to $1 million towards his research over the next 5 years. Coming up next, the brave new world of telehealth. It's an uphill battle trying to provide comprehensive health services to remote communities, or simply keeping up with all the new technology and research. Dr. Peter Sargis is a physician and the manager of the Health Informatics Unit at the Alberta Research Council. His mission is to marry new media with new medicine as a new way to deliver healthcare, and he calls it telehealth.
Telehealth basically is using advanced telecommunications technologies to deliver health services over a distance, so that if you have a specialist, say in Edmonton, and an individual with their family doctor in Grand Prairie who wants to see that specialist, perhaps that individual doesn't need to travel into Edmonton but might be able to use, say, a video conference to connect with that specialist.
Is that something, though, that can give you the quality of care that or information that you really need?
It turns out that for some applications, using that technology might give you more information than you might get with a face-to-face visit, just because additional information can be shared using information technology where parts of your health information record might be collected from a number of care providers as part of that activity. So for a number of applications, yes, it can provide the same, sometimes better quality than you might get in a face-to-face encounter.
Now, is this something that's born out of necessity because it's hard to get physicians or the needed technicians out into the remote areas, or is it just moving along with the new technology?
In healthcare now, increasingly we're under pressure to improve the access of services for all persons in Alberta. And because certain specialists, certain types of care providers are limited in terms of their numbers, it is becoming a necessity to use these types of approaches to increase their reach. Also, as pressures on the healthcare system increase to use our resources more efficiently, information technologies are one of the ways that we can bring different types of care to individuals in a more efficient way.
What is the role of the Alberta Research Council then in this telehealth movement?
At the Alberta Research Council, what we're trying to do is bridge the needs of the healthcare delivery organizations, like regional health authorities, against some of the technologies that are provided by the private sector. For a variety of reasons, healthcare hasn't moved as quickly to use advanced information technologies. And at Alberta Research Council, we're playing a role in bridging that gap to make sure that the technologies that are used, for example, work together with one another, and also that the right types of approaches for using the technology are made aware to the technology providers so that they can bring tools that are most useful to healthcare providers.
Is this a challenge or an obstacle that stuff doesn't work together?
Oh, very much so. I think in most other walks of life, we've come to assume that when you plug your computer into a printer, they're going to work together because most other information technology areas have overcome some of those standards issues that we haven't yet addressed in healthcare. The reality is right now, because a lot of the different tools that are out there aren't built to work together, people might have the unfortunate experience of assuming that they can connect from one place to another, and it turns out that because they're different systems, they won't work together in the way that you'd expect. And what the Alberta Research Council has done is we've created a laboratory environment where you can test whether two systems work together for a specific application like teleultrasound, like telepsychiatry, like teleophthalmology. It turns out that we're the only lab of our kind in Canada, and in fact we're leaders in North America and have now been asked on an international level to assist with developing some of these standards that can assure that different systems will be able to work together.
How is this working now with the telehealth system?
Right now in Alberta there are over 200 applications that are currently being used that take advantage of telehealth technologies. Let me give you a couple of examples. In northern Alberta, one of the challenges that we faced is that there weren't enough radiologists available so that women who were seeking routine ultrasound during their pregnancy might have to travel long distances to get that. By using telehealth, and in this case what we call teleultrasound, we were able to have the radiologist participate from a distance in the ultrasound itself and then interpret the ultrasound over a distance so that the woman did not have to make a long trip to get that routine ultrasound during pregnancy.
So it's all happening in real time as the little gadget is going over the tummy and then the images are being sent back. The physician can see it, the radiologist can see it, and then right away tell, do this, do that, or here's what we see.
Yeah. It can happen in real time, or if the physician also wants to capture the images to consult with a different radiologist or look at them in more detail, they can capture those images and interpret them at a more leisurely pace.
What are some of the other areas that you're working in?
With respect to things that are going on in Alberta that that are starting to benefit from systems working together, telepsychiatry is another area where we've had some success in Alberta. We have a significant shortage of psychiatrists, not only in Alberta, but in Canada as a whole. And so one of the ways that we're able to extend their ability to provide their services to a larger population is to have them conduct their sessions over a video conference. And that's been one of our big success stories here in Alberta, is the use of the technology for psychiatric services.
What are further applications for this?
Well, one of the things that we're looking at is how do we move the way that we offer health care out of hospitals and doctor's offices and right into people in their homes or in their offices. So for certain health conditions that are of a chronic nature, something like diabetes or perhaps asthma, the type of care that that's best for the individual is the kind that helps them make decisions on a daily basis. And so we're looking at ways that we can use internet-based technologies to help individuals communicate with a variety of different care providers. It might be their family physician, it might be a specialist, it might be a nurse or a dietitian. We're looking at ways that that information can be shared amongst a team where the individual is leading that team and making decisions about their own health care on a day-to-day basis, as opposed to on just those occasions where they visit with their doctor.
You're a practicing physician. How did you get involved with this?
Well, a number of years ago, as I was finishing my clinical training, I became interested in those areas of healthcare that I thought were going to change the most dramatically over the next 5 to 15 years. And it was clear to me that while the use of information technology in a lot of other areas of day-to-day life was taking off, it wasn't quite happening yet in healthcare. And so I became interested in ways that we could explore our needs in the healthcare system so as to best take advantage of these tools to make for not only better healthcare delivery, but in the long term, a sustainable healthcare system.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Peter Sargis, a practicing physician in Calgary, and he's also the manager of the Health Informatics Unit at the Alberta Research Council. Some of the most prolific tinkers are farmers, and that's certainly borne out in a new publication called Inventive Spirit, Alberta Patents from 1905 to 1975. Historian Catherine Cole pored over thousands of records in the Canadian Patent Office to develop this list of Alberta inventions. Some are whimsical, some revolutionary and critical to Alberta's progress, such as the noble plow. And along the way, Catherine delivers some new insight into what motivated these Alberta men and women to come up with better ways of doing things.
I've always been interested in items that were manufactured in Alberta, and I did my master's thesis on the Great Western Garment Company, and GWG had a number of patents, and I was quite interested in the fact that these things had been patented and developed here. And from there, it just sort of grew to a broader interest in the kinds of things that Albertans were producing.
Now, why 1905 to 1975?
Well, it was the easiest period of time to get information from the Canadian Patents Records Office, which is the body of work that we were dealing with. The period prior to 1905, you could find out what was patented by an Albertan, but of course Alberta didn't exist as a province at that time. And so the items are all listed under Northwest Territories, and so you'd have to know the name of the town and go through all of the Saskatchewan material as well as the Alberta material and sort it out. The period post-1975, the Patents Office themselves stopped recording where people were from, and they only indicated Canada. So that makes it a lot more difficult for us to try to figure out where the people were from.
In your book, you've listed several thousand patents during this period. Is that fairly representative of the tinkering or the number of inventors in the province?
There are over 4,000 inventions included in Inventive Spirit. And these are all just things that are patented. There would, of course, have been far more inventions of things that people had developed but had not patented for whatever reason, whether they wanted to make it more accessible to the general public or whether they just didn't see themselves in those terms or felt it was too expensive, whatever. So we have more than 4,000 patented inventions within Alberta. They do, in terms of the time period within that 70-year period that things were invented, you can see a change in the kinds of inventions that people were inventing and the kinds of inventors that were working. In the earlier period, you see far more of the individual inventor, the independent person who was working away in his garage or in his machine shop, doing his own thing. And I say his because most of them were men. There were, of the over 4,000, fewer than 100 were women. In the later period, particularly post-Second World War, far more of the inventions were things that are being developed either by corporations or by government or by universities. And it's in the later period, because of advances in technology, it requires far more money, expertise, sophistication, equipment, all of that kind of thing. And so you see fewer and fewer of the small independent inventors.
One of the things that I really like about your book is that through the introductory part, you actually go through the stories of some of these fellows and the inventions that they've come up with in the early days. And one of my favorites is the fellow who came up with the life-saving device that you carried around in a valise.
John Edlund was a man from southern Alberta who developed a combination valise and life-saving device. It was patented in 1916. And the Glenbow Archives has a whole series of photographs of this valise and him with the valise in various positions. He was a photographer as well as being an inventor, and so that's why we have such a good record of the item that he developed. It's a really bizarre-looking thing. I mean, it looks a bit like a frogman when he's standing in it with, you know, flippers out the sides for his arms, and it's the big traditional top-opening valise that men used in that period. The timing of it being in 1916 suggests that it's something that he invented in the post Titanic period, when people realized that there weren't enough lifeboats on deck for those who drowned in the Titanic, and there were a number of different combination devices for people to use as lifesavers. There was a woman who developed one that was a purse life-saving device as well. So it was an idea that was in people's minds in that period.
Do you have any stories about women inventors?
Well, as I say, there were very few women who were inventors, but one of the women that we know a little bit about is a woman from Tofield, Alberta, who developed a combination hoe and rake.
What was her name?
Her name was Frances Kalal, and she was, in fact, a master farmer. She and her husband had quite an amazing farm out at Tofield, and she was really well known locally for the quality of her vegetable gardens and flower gardens. And, in fact, there was a photograph of her in the paper with a citrus fruit tree that she had managed to get citrus fruit to grow on indoors in Alberta. So she was a great gardener and domestic.
Who were some of the inventors who really made a success of what they were doing?
Well, some of the names that are certainly well-known to Albertans would be, for example, Charles Noble, who ran the factory at Nobleford for many years and invented a lot of ploughs and agricultural machinery that really made a difference in terms of agricultural development in Alberta. Bruce Nodwell of Calgary invented an off-road vehicle that is used in the oil industry. The tracked wheels were his development, and that really made it possible for people to move on the muskeg and opened up whole new areas of the province. A number of the inventions that were developed here were things where people were responding to the geography or the climate of Alberta and developing things that were specifically required here. So there were things that people in other parts of the country weren't even looking at.
Thank you very much, Catherine.
You're welcome.
That was historian Catherine Cole, and I have a signed copy of her book, Inventive Spirit, to give away. Just click on the Innovation Alberta website and enter your name by email into the draw. And this Science Heritage segment of Innovation Alberta was sponsored by the Historical Resources Foundation of Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Check out our website. You can listen to past programs in real audio or download them from the internet. And you can enter contests. That's at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Paul Pates. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.